Virginia.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Donahue from the Fairfax Public Defender's Office. On behalf of Mirgazi Khoroshev, I would ask this court to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am.
Today, Mr. Khoroshev asked this court to vacate his conviction on 4 assignments of error, the first being that the trial court erred when it admitted the December 28, 2012 protective order, as that order was void ab initio. In this case, on December 28th, the juvenile court entered a so-called extended protective order.
Let's talk about the concept, if we could, of void ab initio, which is different from the other kind of void. And void ab initio suggests to me that the court did not have the jurisdiction whatsoever to enter an order of that kind, correct?
It is our position today that the juvenile court was without statutory authority to enter this order.
Okay, and why is it that you believe the court does not have statutory authority when the ability to enter protective orders, at least at the preliminary stage and at the final stage once matters in juvenile court, is indeed given by statute to the juvenile court?
Certainly the juvenile court does have authority to enter protective orders, but in the procedural posture that the juvenile court found this case on December 28th, the court was prohibited under Virginia Code Section 16.1-253.1 from entering an extended protective order. Because Mr. Khoroshev was present and because he motioned for a continuance, the code only permitted the court to continue the hearing. And the code explicitly states that under those circumstances, the preliminary order shall remain in effect until the hearing. And the preliminary order in this case relates back to December 13th, 2012, the original order that was entered by the juvenile court. The code only authorizes a so-called extended protective order in circumstances when the respondent is not served or is served but is incarcerated, which was not the case here.
Let me make sure I understand your argument, counsel, because a little bit challenged by the way that it was presented. In the trial court, was it your position that the trial court erred by admitting the order because it was void ab initio, or is it your view, or was it that you raised that the trial court's reliance on the 12-28-12 preliminary protective order was incorrect?
Your Honor, in the trial court, we did argue that the December 28th order was void, and that's noted in the statement of facts located on appendix pages 35 through 37. So we did raise the issue in the trial court that the December 28th order was void. We did challenge its admission and argued essentially, but for its admission, there would not be an essential element of the case proven, which was the existence of a protective order in this case. So that issue was preserved in the trial court.
But your brief talks about the trial court's reliance on the 12-28-12 preliminary protective order, correct?
Our brief indicates and states that the trial court relied on the December 28th order as being the operative protective order in effect at the time of the date of the offense, and relied on that order as being the one that attached criminal liability to Mr. Khoroshev's actions. But again, we did argue to the trial court that this was not the proper order before the court, that it was void and therefore inadmissible and was not to be admitted in order to satisfy this element of the offense.
Would you agree or disagree that is a different legal inquiry or an analytical framework when we decide whether or not the admissibility of the protective order is different than the reliance on the protective order? Are those the same thing or are they different?
Your Honor, I think in this case it was made very clear to the trial court that, one, we objected to its admission based on our position that the juvenile court lacked statutory authority to enter the order, and also was made clear to the trial court that we were arguing that the court should therefore not rely on this order to satisfy an element of the criminal offense, which was the existence of a protective order that was in existence at the time of the offense. The Commonwealth bore the burden of providing the operative preliminary protective order, and as we stated to the trial court, the correct order should have been the one from December 13th, 2012, and that was not offered into evidence. And there was no testimony regarding what the terms and conditions from that order were. So I do believe that regardless of how the trial court interpreted our argument, we did articulate to the trial court that, one, we objected to its admissibility, and also argued that this order from December 28th was not to be relied on in satisfying the elements, the prima facie case for the Commonwealth's case on a violation of a protective order.
And I appreciate you saying that, but doesn't that present the issue that we need to get to before we get to the real substance of your argument? And that is, at the trial level, it is the responsibility of trial counsel to make sure that the trial court is ruling on the precise issue that you're presenting on appeal, because of the view that we want to make sure the trial courts have an opportunity to make a decision on the case before we consider whether or not it was error on appellate review. So was it your responsibility to make sure that the trial court understood precisely what issue you were raising at the trial level?
And Your Honor, again, I would point the court to our objection. We made the exact argument before the trial court that this order was void ab initio and therefore was inadmissible because it was without legal effect when it came into existence. And therefore, the trial court could not then use this order going forward in the case as the proper protective order in effect. I do believe that the trial court understood our objection and ultimately looked at the statutory language in 16.1, 253.1 to say it was sort of inherent in the statute that an extended protective order comports with the procedural requirements the juvenile court had available at the time. Your Honor, moving aside from whether or not the order itself was void ab initio, that does bring us to our second assignment of error, where we argued that the December 28th preliminary protective order, its admission was in error by the trial court because Mr. Carocia's confrontation rights under the Sixth Amendment were violated, as neither the sheriff's deputy who served the protective order nor the Russian interpreter who were present at the hearing were present at trial and subject to cross-examination.
Neither the sheriff nor the translator were declarants, though, right? Neither the sheriff nor the interpreter would have been declarants, and so doesn't your position, the Sixth Amendment confrontation right, give a right to confront whoever has made the declaration, and neither the sheriff nor the translator would fit that?
Well, and Your Honor, that's where we would disagree. Under the Sixth Amendment, only testimonial statements are subject to the requirements of the Confrontation Clause.
Right.
And we know under Crawford versus Commonwealth that a testimonial statement, the standard, is one that is made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonable to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. And in Crawford, of course, the document at issue was an ex parte affidavit for a protective order, which coincidentally could be very much the case here because the preliminary protective order from December 28th does indicate on page one of the first page of that order that it's ex parte. But we would certainly argue today that the preliminary protective order, which is page 1, 2, and 3, and that third page does include the accompanying page of service filled out by the sheriff's deputy that's used and submitted into evidence in order to establish notice, that is certainly a testimonial statement.
There are no cases in Virginia that are precisely on point, but it seems to me, in looking at the authority from other jurisdictions, that every other jurisdiction has found that these things do not qualify as being testimonial. So Virginia would be in the minority if we were to conclude otherwise, wouldn't we?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the reason I say that is because in the cases cited by the Commonwealth and in the other instances of items that have been deemed non-testimonial, for example, a Department of Motor Vehicle transcript or a service page in another state. What's different here is that this was the result of an ex parte proceeding, and all of the cases still indicate that ex parte communications get to the very heart of confrontation, and that's why we have those safeguards under the Sixth Amendment. So this isn't a situation where there was communication between everyone and then this was sought to be introduced at a later trial. This is something that gets to the very heart of confrontation because it was based on communication when Mr. Khrushchev was not present.
The closest case that we can talk about as far as being analytically consistent in another jurisdiction is the case cited by the Commonwealth versus Chakouin. And it says, "The primary purpose for which the return of service in this case was created is to serve the routine administrative functions of the court system, ensuring that the defendant received the fair notice to which he is statutorily and constitutionally entitled." And I was reading right from that case. Why is it that you believe that analytical framework is flawed?
Well, under Virginia and under Crawford, the primary purpose is not the standard that's to be applied in Virginia. The standard is whether the document was made under circumstances that would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. So yes, there are other functions this serve. It does have a ministerial function, but whether or not that's the primary purpose is not controlling and isn't the appropriate standard. And I would note for the court, again, under Crawford versus Commonwealth, when we're talking about an affidavit that was deemed testimonial, that's the same nature. They found that because the affidavit described acts made by the defendant, in that case in an ex parte proceeding, that would certainly lead an objective witness reasonably to believe it would be available for use at a trial. And so a preliminary protective order in this case, with the accompanying page of service, which prohibits contact between the respondent and the petitioner, and an order which expressly cautions the respondent that any violation of this order will result in criminal consequences, including incarceration, that would lead an objective person to believe that this was going to be used at a later prosecution. So it is our position that this preliminary protective order in its entirety does constitute testimonial document. It is testimonial, and therefore the sheriff's deputy who served the order and the Russian interpreter who was present at the court date would be required in order to satisfy the constitutional safeguards under the Confrontation Clause. Moving on to assignment of error number 3, with the court's permission, we also argue that the trial court erred in denying Mr. Khoroshev's motion to strike and renewed motion to strike because the evidence was insufficient to prove that he had actual notice of the terms and conditions of that order. And this becomes a little more interesting given this court's recent unpublished opinion in Cardenas, which I will say was argued around the same time during the same panel that this writ argument was made. But what I would ask the court to do in looking at the Cardenas opinion, which is essentially stated that personal service effectuates notice upon the recipient, I'd ask this court not to adopt such a bright line rule. And the reason for that is because adopting such a bright line rule can lead down a dangerous road, because it ignores not only the diversity of the United States in terms of cultural and ethnic backgrounds, but it also ignores the idea that certain individuals in our community suffer from both mental health issues, physical handicaps, whether it be literacy or illiteracy, and also, as I said,
suggest to you the panel that heard that case was very sensitive to the concerns raised, but found that there is no additional responsibility on the part of the government to ensure the types of things that you're talking about, but rather the burden, and I'm not using that from a legal standpoint, but the burden is on the person that's part of the litigation to find out what the circumstances and consequences of the actions are.
And again, Your Honor, with all due respect, we ask the court to not adopt such a bright line rule and to consider the distinguishing characteristics between the Cardenas case and the Khoroshev case that we have here today. In Cardenas, on the record, it was noted that not only was the defendant in that case able to answer questions in English posed by the court, there was testimony that...
Basically, in Cardenas, we came to the conclusion that the defendant was not actually being truthful in his inability to understand what was going on.
And we can't draw the same conclusion in this case here. There was absolutely no other evidence submitted during trial that evidenced Mr. Khoroshev's familiarity with the English language, though it easily could have. There could have been questions by the Commonwealth posed at concluding what was discussed inside the courtroom on December 28th, whether she heard a Russian interpreter speaking to him. Those are the sorts of things that easily could have been brought out in trial and weren't. And so in this case, much unlike the Cardenas case, there is no evidence that Mr. Khoroshev was being deceitful with the court or dishonest.
So you would suggest that in the context of cases like this where there is a concern by the trial court that the defendant or the respondent may not understand what's going on, it's appropriate or the responsibility of the court to do some sort of independent colloquy to assure or ensure that the respondent understands what's going on?
I think on a case-by-case basis, the Commonwealth, when it becomes aware of the individual defendant's attributes, whether it be a language deficiency, a reading deficiency, a physical handicap, or whatever the case may be, it's incumbent upon the Commonwealth, in order to satisfy the requirement of actual notice, actual understanding of the terms and conditions of the protective order, that the Commonwealth provide that evidence and not be an affirmative defense by the...
But other than federal cases, you're not able to cite any Virginia cases that stand for that proposition, are you?
No, I think the area of notice and protective orders hasn't... there's not too much out there, with the exception of the cases that have been cited by the brief. And I see my time.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Is there a rest for rebuttal? Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Victoria Johnson, and I represent the Commonwealth.
Yes, ma'am.
To begin, Your Honor, I think the court picked up on a distinction that I raised in my brief between the admissibility of evidence and the sufficiency of evidence. Here, the basis for the objection, according to the written statement of facts, was the admissibility of the December 28th order. However, the brief goes on to argue that the evidence was insufficient to support the notice requirement in that same argument. Here, though,
so one is an evidentiary standard and one is a
sufficiency
standard.
Yes, Your Honor. And there's really no argument on brief or in the record as to what the evidentiary standard was. Why is an evidentiary matter a purportedly void order would be inadmissible? I submit that would go to the weight of the evidence rather than the admissibility. And there's just no argument about that on the appellant's brief.
Assuming for the sake of discussion that we're talking semantics, and I'm not saying that we necessarily are.
Sure.
What would be your response to your opponent and colleague's argument?
On the merits?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Your Honor. I submit that the court has broad discretion in how it can write its orders in these situations. According to the facts of this case, there was a December 13th order.
The code provision, as I understand it, recognizes that a court can continue a protective order for due cause, essentially. And in this case, the court extended the protective order. And we may say, well, it's just, you know, words. But the bottom line is the court did something that is not literally consistent with the prerogatives under the statute.
All of the language in the statute is discretionary. The statute says that the court may extend the protective order for a period not to exceed 6 months. However, upon motion of the respondent for good cause shown, the court may continue the hearing. And so I submit that with that language, the court has very broad discretion in what it's going to do as far as entering another order. Furthermore, on the facts of this case, we know that the December 13th order had expired. The parties were in court on the hearing on the preliminary protective order. On the 28th, the 15-day hearing. Also, drawing the court's attention to page 3 of the joint appendix, I know that the defendant takes the position that this was an ex parte hearing because the box is checked stating ex parte proceeding only. However, the court has written, I assume the court, has written on the order itself.
Who was in attendance?
Yeah, petitioner, mm-hmm. petitioner's counsel, excuse me, yes, Your Honor. Petitioner's counsel, respondent, and Russian interpreter present. So I don't know that that can really be called an ex parte hearing. Furthermore, looking at page 4 of the order itself, and this is the form that's approved by the Supreme Court of Virginia, the proper block is checked. It's ordered that the preliminary protective order is extended upon motion of the respondent and for good cause shown.
Exactly. Did the appellant not request the continuance and therefore to have the protective order extended? What is the procedure, and we know he did, what is the procedure once it is extended? If we follow the reasoning that appellant has here, how would one extend, how would In a perfect world, how would the judge have extended that order? Does not a new order have to be entered in order for it to be going into VCN, in order to have officers aware and have this served on the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's the real world practicality of this case. The court had to enter something. The court had to enter an order because apparently the December 13th order was not there. We don't know what happened to the December 13th order. It's not on the record, so we just have no idea what happened. The court had to do something on December the 28th. Something had to be entered. And as the trial judge said in this case, there's more than one way to write a court order. And I submit that our juvenile and domestic relations judges are the judges in this Commonwealth who should have the broadest discretion, and who have extremely broad discretion under statute, under Title 16.1, to make these kind of day-by-day decisions that they have to do. And so that's my position, is that the court was not acting ultra vires. It was not acting without statutory authority here. Instead, it was fulfilling its mandate from the General Assembly to give the parties notice, to adjudicate the case before it, to enter an order that would, as Judge Chaykin said, that would allow the order to be entered into VCN and for the protective order to be effectuated.
Well, the other order was expiring or had
yes.
expired. So essentially, common sense would tell us that we have to do something. So what would have been, as far as the Commonwealth's concerned, what would have been the proper way to do that? Would you have taken the old order and had it re-entered from that date forward?
I believe, and I wasn't present, obviously, below.
I understand that.
But I think, and I don't want to put words in the opposing counsel's mouth at all, but I think that this case boils down to, even if the appellant had gotten exactly what he wanted, he still would have been under a protective order. And I don't know how the form would have been written any differently, given the form approved by the Supreme Court.
Which may explain why the court noted that people were there and checked the box ex parte, because it is an ex parte hearing, but it's not an ex parte order because we haven't gotten to the final hearing because the respondent is asking for a continuance.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, it has not yet been adjudicated, and that happened. It would have happened at some time in the future, but I believe the order, the preliminary protective order, was violated. And whether that was adjudicated in the future, the protective order itself, it's just not in our record.
But ultimately, none of this would have been at issue had he moved forward with the proceeding as it was called. He was the one that requested the continuance. Is that not correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, it is. And that is plain on the face of the record. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court has on this issue, or I'll move on to the Confrontation Clause issue.
Feel free.
Thank you. Going to the Confrontation Clause issue, Your Honor, I think to boil down that issue just real simply, we can look to the language of Melendez-Diaz. And in Melendez-Diaz, the Supreme Court of the United States.
And that's where they pull the primary purpose language that was stated in the Massachusetts case that I made reference to. Isn't that where that primary purpose language comes from in Melendez-Diaz?
Yes, Your Honor. And that language has continued to have facility in Bullcoming and in the other later cases, I believe Wilson from the Supreme Court, that aren't cited in my brief that are kind of general knowledge, I think, in this area of the law. Here, we can kind of look to see if the certificate of service is like the certificates of the forensic certificates at issue in Melendez-Diaz. Here, this wasn't requested by law enforcement during the course of an investigation. The violation of the order didn't occur until after service was completed, so there's no way the order could have been prepared in anticipation of a criminal trial.
Would you suggest that this court adopt and or follow the language from the Massachusetts case that was previously cited, where the focus becomes a primary purpose of the administrative order being entered to facilitate the information process and the like?
I don't know that this court needs to necessarily adopt the primary purpose test, as I don't believe that that has been fully worked out in the lower courts yet. I don't think that's a bright line yet. However, I think that this court can use the framework of Melendez-Diaz, and this, the courts in this Commonwealth have done that on many occasions. To note that the certificate of service was made for a ministerial purpose. It could not have been made for a criminal trial because the criminal violation had not yet taken place. It's not necessarily a primary purpose. That's really.
But you would concede that a preliminary protective order hearing is quasi-criminal in nature, and that the affidavit that is being relied on, that is filed by petitioner in that case, is used for the primary purpose of adjudicating certain rights and responsibilities pending a final hearing on the matter.
The underlying affidavit is testimony. The victim's underlying affidavit is testimonial under Crawford v. Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is no accuser here. The sheriff who, or the deputy sheriff who served this document, did not accuse the defendant of doing anything. He fulfilled his ministerial task that he is required to do by law, by Code Section 16.12.
But your opponent colleague would argue that the predicate for action being taken against the respondent is based upon the fact that he has received notice of this proceeding that has gone forward against him.
Your Honor, I have to disagree with that. The reason that notice is given of this preliminary protective order is because it's required by our Virginia statute. It is issued, I submit, in the hope that the defendant will comply with it, not that he will violate it and then be prosecuted. He is constitutionally.
Even though it says on the preliminary protective order that you can go to jail if you don't follow the rules.
I think that's a strong incentive to comply with the order, Your Honor. And the purpose for this certificate of service is to comply with 16.1253.1, is not to prosecute the defendant.
Okay.
And it cannot be to prosecute the defendant because no crime has yet been committed. And if that requires adopting the primary purpose test, then as the Michigan court did, then I believe that is the correct analysis.
Okay.
Moving on to the notice issue, just very briefly, Your Honor. The notice issue has already been adjudicated by this court, albeit in an unpublished opinion in Cardenas. However, as to the issues that are brought up by counsel, of course the court is aware of the diversity, particularly in Northern Virginia, and the various needs of various populations. However, as many other courts have dealt with these issues, the burden on the state outweighs these other issues, and those cases were all cited in my brief. Furthermore, Virginia law has long held that personal service is actual notice, fulfills the requirement of actual notice. That's the Smoot case, and I submit that case decides this issue. And finally, Your Honor, as to the jury question, just to touch on that very briefly, that issue is not preserved for appeal. Although the appellant has raised it under the ends of justice exception to Rule 5A18, that issue would have been very easily taken care of by noting it to the trial court at the time. The trial court made a Scrivener's error in answering that question. I submit that common sense would allow the jury to correctly read that. Furthermore, Your Honor, There is no evidence in this case that the defendant was convicted of otherwise innocent behavior, which is the standard the appellant cited on brief, and is the correct standard for a miscarriage of justice. Here the record is replete with evidence that the defendant had notice because he was able to understand, because he was able to arrive at the December 28th hearing. He was able to, when asked by the officer what was going on, he had a story ready. He said that my wife texted me, so that indicates that he understood the situation a little bit. So the court had evidence before it that indicates that the defendant had notice here. If the court has any further questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
You have about 3 minutes.
Yes, sir. May it please the court, and in response to the arguments raised on the first assignment of error, I would just point the court's attention to the language in 16.1.253.1. Commonwealth would argue that the language in that statute is discretionary. But the code explicitly states that the preliminary order shall remain in effect until the hearing. And so regardless of whether or not the protective order was set to expire on that day, the juvenile court was authorized to continue the hearing. And in those circumstances, the preliminary order shall remain in effect. And that's what should have happened. When we talk about what an ideal—
Excuse me, how would you make that remain in effect without being able to serve your client with that order and without being able to go forward with the process to have it entered into VCN so that officers have the ability that the state knows that your client's under a continued protective order? How would the mechanics of that work?
I think if we look at pages 3 and 4 of the appendix, which is the form that's provided by the Supreme Court, it indicates that there's a box on the second page where it says it's further ordered that a full hearing on the petition will be heard on such and such day, and it's ordered that the preliminary protective order is extended upon motion. No other boxes before that should have been marked, essentially. The juvenile court did not have to make any further findings or any other orders relating to the terms and conditions of the contact permitted between the parties, because that was already included in the December 12th order. And this court cannot speculate that the December 12th terms or December 13th terms and conditions were thereby mirrored in the boxes marked on the December 28th order. So in a perfect world, the December 28th order would really have just included the boxes marked on the second page that would have been served upon the parties, and that could have gone forward into entry into the electronic databases.
Isn't that in effect done on page 3 in the joint appendix at the very top, the box that's marked extension of preliminary protective order?
That is marked, but then it also goes forward on the bottom of the page to indicate the respondent shall not commit acts of family abuse, the respondent shall have no contact. The respondent shall have no contact of any kind, and it goes forward. And those terms and conditions, it's our contention, based on the statutory language, the juvenile court was not permitted to make those findings or to make those conditions on December 28th. Those conditions and terms were properly before the juvenile court on December 13th when it entered the preliminary protective order. And that document should have been merely continued and the December 28th order. No other findings or orders by the court needed to be made. And with respect to, again, whether this issue is properly before the court in terms of an admissibility versus a sufficiency argument, I'd ask the court, and as we indicated in our reply brief, when the Commonwealth raised this argument, by challenging the admissibility of this document, which was being offered to prove an element of the offense, the appellant here was arguing that but for its admission and but for the trial court's error, the evidence was insufficient. And when we talk about what the statement of facts contains on pages 35 and through 37, there is a notation that the court posed the question to the defense, and the defense argued it would be the Commonwealth's burden to produce the original preliminary protective order on December 13th. So we were getting to the heart of the sufficiency and the admissibility.
Okay, counsel, your time's expired. We'll come down and greet you.